This is How Sound, the backstory to great radio storytelling. How Sound is a production of PRX and Transom. I'm Rob Rosenthal. The other day, I was listening to Revisionist History. Do you listen to Revisionist History? It's the podcast by Malcolm Gladwell. I find it to be sharp, witty, clever, makes you say, I never thought of it that way.
The podcasts themselves very much follow the form of a sermon.
Julia Barton is an editor at the podcast.
They have elements of reporting, they have interviews, they have statistics, they're all fact-checked, but they're in essence, they are sermons.
I'm really interested in how Julia edits the show. Just generally, what does she do as an editor to shape and focus and trim the stories? And how does she work with Malcolm, who's a print guy? But the first thing I needed to know had to do with an episode where you don't find out what the story is about for 13 minutes. 13! That's forever. Let's run through it. The episode is called Burden of Proof. Here's the opening.
Well, please tell me a little bit about what Owen was like.
When Owen was born, he was screaming and his neck veins were out. And the doctor said, this is a Viking. And I think that's kind of the way he lived a lot. You know, that kind of passion. So that's the way he lived.
The man speaking is Tom Thomas. He's sitting with his wife, Kathy Brearley. She's English. Both she and Tom are United Church pastors. They met when they were missionaries in Zambia. They have a son named Morgan. And we're all at Morgan's house just outside of Allentown, Pennsylvania, a bungalow in a tidy subdivision. There are two little children running around and a big friendly dog being big and friendly. Everyone has gathered to talk about Owen, the Viking. The son and brother who isn't there. My name is Malcolm Gladwell. You're listening to Revisionist History, my podcast about things overlooked and misunderstood. This episode is about Owen Thomas, a young man I never had the chance to meet, about what happened to him and why we shouldn't forget about him.
That's good. It establishes a bit of mystery. Who's Owen? Why isn't he there? Sounds like something bad may have happened. But his story is important, and we shouldn't forget about him.
I went to see Owen's family on a cold winter evening.
We knew that he was kind of feeling down, feeling depressed. Last month or so.
Next in the story, we spend more time with the family and learn about Owen. He was driven, good in school, the kind of student who was bummed if he got an A-. But he was also having emotional difficulties, highly stressed, a type A guy who demanded a lot of himself.
But the Sunday night he called, he really sounded depressed then. He really did. And you know, now you look back, we should have just got in the car and gone right down.
What did he talk about in that last call?
Well, it'd be my birthday, so he was wishing me happy birthday. I don't know, what did he talk to you about, Tom?
Well,
he said I'm failing everything. That's what he said.
From there, the story takes an unusual turn, a non sequitur, it seems. After this introduction to Owen and his emotional troubles, Malcolm takes us to a lecture, one that he gave about coal dust. Not Owen, but coal dust and an obscure historical figure from over 100 years ago.
I had been assigned a theme, proof. That's obviously a big topic, so I thought that this afternoon I would start by asking a relatively simple question, which is, what level of proof do we need about the harmfulness of some activity before we act? I decided to tell the story of a man named Frederick Hoffman, a remarkable man. Born in 1865 in Germany, immigrated to the United States, Hoffman rose to the position of senior statistician at the Prudential Insurance Company. At the time, that was a hugely important job. This was in the years before Social Security or Medicare. Private insurers were the safety net. And because they had to figure out what to charge for life insurance premiums, they had to closely monitor the health of Americans. And that was Hoffman's job. he set out and he would cover the entire country, and he would go and visit towns and cities and villages all across this land, and he would interview doctors and hospitals and funeral directors, and he would visit all the major employers, and he would go to the cemeteries, and he would talk to people, and he would walk around the town, and he would try and get a sense of what people are dying of. Hoffman was one of the first people to sound the alarm about smoking. He was one of the first to describe the terrible health conditions on Indian reservations. But perhaps his most important work concerned what was known at the time as miner's asthma. I give a fair number of talks, and one of the things that you can usually tell is if you've lost your audience. And I remember that day at Penn thinking that I had no idea. 20 minutes in, I began to panic a little because I'm going on and on about Hoffman, about coal mining, about how big a deal coal was at the turn of the century, about how much dust the process of coal mining created, about how coal miners would have coughing fits and spit up this black inky substance. And they would cough more and more of it the more they mined and the more time they spent in the coal mines. That was absolutely beyond question. The audience is incredibly quiet, and I couldn't figure out if that was because they found the subject as fascinating as I did, or if they were thinking, what on earth?
That's what I was thinking, for sure. What on earth? Where's Owen? Where's his family?
The thing that no one could agree on was that, whether that was dangerous. Did it harm the health of someone to inhale all of this dust from coal mining? Miners' asthma wasn't bothering the metal.
Malcolm goes on to describe a report by Hoffman, one that was published in 1918. In short, miners were dying of asthma at rates 5 times higher than other working men. The report is published and...
nothing happens. Nothing. Nothing whatsoever. And why does nothing happen? Because all kinds of people stood up and read Hoffman's report and said, you've got no proof. Let's give the students at Penn credit for their patience, because this part of my talk went on for a very long time. But I was trying to answer the question at the core of proof. At what point do you act? People argued after Hoffman published his report that we still didn't know quite enough, that he had a lot of suggestive evidence, but not definitive evidence. And that was true. But it was also irrelevant, because if you wait until the evidence is perfect and complete, you'll never act. It was not until the 1970s that people suddenly realized that tens of thousands of miners were dying horrible deaths vastly prematurely because of the dust they inhaled while working in the mines. Now, I think we can all agree that that is a appalling story, right? That should never have happened. We should have acted on this in 1918. Instead, we acted on this in 1975. We look around the room and we say to ourselves, we would never do that, would we? We're much too educated and sophisticated and empathetic to ever look at the suffering of someone else and say, oh, we're not going to act until we have proof. But we do that. All of us do that. Everyone in this room is doing that, even as we speak. Now, what am I talking about? I'm talking about football.
Oh, this is where Malcolm's going. Football. Owen's family now returns to the story, and we learn that Owen was a lineman for the football team at the University of Pennsylvania, the place where Malcolm was speaking. And Owen loved to hit, couldn't wait to hit. Malcolm says he interviewed Owen's parents with Owen's scratched and dented football helmets lined up on the kitchen table.
He was named captain of the football team. 76 out of the 80 players voted for him. Then one day, out of the blue, in the spring of his junior year, he hung himself in his apartment.
This is a tragic story, for sure, and it's at this moment Malcolm fully lands the focus of the story, tying the disparate parts together. For the rest of the episode, Malcolm reports on football and concussions and CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, and of course, Owen. Now keep in mind, this moment where Malcolm focuses the story, it's 13 minutes in.
Yeah, I mean, when he brought that story in, it took even longer. So
that's Julia Barton again. In addition to refining and cutting and moving elements around, sometimes in her role as an editor, Julia advocates for getting to the point sooner, which apparently was a bone of contention in this case.
People were all like, this is taking too long to understand what the story is about. And he was like, well, that's the point. And we were like, okay, you know, you're the one who's going to live and die by this episode.
But as she spent more time with the story, she says she was seduced by it. In fact, that was Malcolm's intent, to be pulled in by the mystery of it all. What happened to Owen? Are Owen and the mining and the asthma connected somehow? But once Malcolm lands the focus, he piles on with data and research and anecdotes about head injuries.
And at some point, you know, as I was editing this, I was like, why am I trying to, like, tone it down? So at some point, I was just like, yeah, let's just drive a stake into it. And, you know, and my editing just changed. Like, he convinced me sort of by holding his ground.
Julia says there's another factor to consider when weighing the pros and cons of a long beginning, Malcolm's fame.
The one thing about working with people who already have their own audience, who already have stature, is that they can get away with more. So they can have these long preambles, in a sense, because you can trust that the audience is curious about them and willing to give them a chance to explain what the story is about. So, you know, they can withhold more information and sort of dole it out in a slower fashion, I think, than some of us who are just ordinary people.
During the section of the story that featured the lecture, did you notice Malcolm commenting a few times on how the speech was going and how he thought he was doing? Initially, there was less of that. It was a long swath of excerpts and summation from the speech. Probably too long, Julia thought. But at one point, Malcolm wrote in his narration, "Let's give credit to the students at Penn for their patience, because this part of my talk went on for a very long time." And that one line gave Julia an idea for breaking up the speech section a bit.
And I was like, there's a tension that I haven't ever thought about before. So he has a speaking career. He goes all over the world and, like, gives keynote speeches and things like that. And I'm like, what is that like? You know, that's an interesting question that I can work with. And I've also, you know, like, what is it like when someone's commenting on their own self giving a speech? And so that was a thing where I felt like, okay, if there's just more of that kind of thing. So I just put questions in the script. I'm like, what is, you know, what's going on in your head as you're giving the speech? I watched it on video and I was like, aren't you a little bit nervous? You really are going on for 20 minutes about a very obscure topic to a bunch of, you know, college undergrads who, you know, could be doing other things. So he started writing more about that. He got it immediately.
According to Julia, Malcolm didn't get writing for radio immediately. Like I said, Malcolm's a print guy. He writes for The New Yorker. He's published several best-selling books. So when he turned to podcasting, the writing was different, and he had to learn that.
I thought his writing was beautiful and really well done, but it had issues, especially around the tape. And so, you know, a lot of it was like, you're not writing to the tape. You're not acknowledging what's in the tape. He was working off transcripts. Like, you know, this person just said something very intense and you're not reacting to it, you know? So I'll make notes like that in the script. And I was just really tough on him. And I think at first it was just like he was a little bit taken aback. And, you know, to his credit, he then was like, oh, I do need to learn about this form. And I think the other thing that's interesting is, like, we would play the tape for him while he was tracking, and we still do that. And he would be hearing it as if new, you know, because he hadn't been overexposed to the tape in the way that we producers kind of get overexposed to it. And we're like, yeah, whatever, because we've listened to it so many times. He didn't have that. So he would be reacting fresh to the tape. And it was like a miracle to him. It was just, he loves it so much. And I think that's why, you know, his enthusiasm just kind of grew about this whole process.
In addition to editing revisionist history, Julia has edited At the World, Weekend America, origin stories from the Leakey Foundation, Life of the Law. Basically, she's put a lot of red ink on scripts.
Do you see yourself
as a boss or a friend or a collaborator or a fixer or a radio therapist? Like, how do you see yourself?
Yeah, it depends on who I'm working with. I think you sort of have to be flexible in the sense of like where that person is at and like what they're capable of understanding at, you know, the sort of place where they are. Because radio is a very, audio itself is a very experiential medium. You kind of don't get it until you've done it. So something that I really appreciated from editors that I had that were good were they would like take the time to explain to me like what was going on and why they were making the edits. And so I've really adopted that mode. So I think it's partly a teacher role in a lot of ways. And then with the people who are more experienced and you're just kind of like helping them get through this process, it's maybe a little more professional therapy, you know. But I feel like the fun of it is the collaborative part where you're just both like, what's going on in here? What is it? Maybe if we tried this, and then like, no, but then that would create this other problem. So what about this? And then you're both like, yeah, that's the way. Why didn't we see that before? And you're suddenly, it's like both of you are in there. So you're taking a little of that burden away from the person, but you're not coming at it like, I know how you must fix this story.
When you're editing someone, how do you help them retain their voice? And let me put it another way. How do you not impose your writing voice on the reporter or the narrator?
Yeah, that's something interesting. I mean, I definitely had to think about it with Gladwell. I mean, not that he would take my copy, but I think both of us don't want that to happen. And so what I'll do, and Google Docs is really helpful in this regard because you can both make a comment. I use suggestion mode, so it's all provisional, but I'll put in the script, you know, something that I call dummy copy. So I'll be like, this is the kind of move that needs to happen here. And then there's room underneath it where I can explain why I'm making that suggested copy. The idea is not that I'm writing the copy for them, but I'm showing them the kind of transition that needs to happen or the kind of summary or the kind of reaction that I think is warranted in this place. And it might be for pacing. It might be just for flow. It might be just because I need you to set up the next piece of tape, you know, things like that. And I feel like it's a failure if somehow I hear my words coming out of someone else's mouth.
What makes a good editor?
I think you have to want to help people. I think you have to be interested in story structure and about what makes a good story and creative about it. And interested to the extent that you don't really care if it's your story, you know, it's not like your tape, but that the challenge of it is interesting. How do I structure this? How do I make sense of it? How do I keep it interesting over time or across episodes and make it something that people can absorb? That's very satisfying. And I think the nice thing about podcasting is that when you do it right and when it gets into people's brains, it has more permanence in a way because it's this experience that they helped build. You know, it's like it's not done until somebody's heard it, and then they're bringing everything that they've heard and that they think and their own arguments, whether even if they don't like it, you know, as if they're engaged with it, then they're creating their own version of that episode. So that's when it's done. It's when it's in somebody else's brain. You just want to make it something that can get into that person's brain. So that's my sermon.
When we talked, Julia laid out the steps of the editorial process at Revisionist History. It's a good primer on how a show gets made. It might inform the way you make your shows. Read about it at the post for this episode at transom.org. Now, on top of that, some years ago, Julia wrote an article for Transom on editing. It's called Cultivating the Editor in Your Brain. It's not just useful for editors. Producers will find it valuable because it's helpful to think like an editor when you're working. Cultivating the Editor in Your Brain at Transom. Believe it or not, one more thing about Julia. She's also a maker. She just released a series for Radiotopia's Showcase called Space Bridge. She produced it with Charles Maines. Space Bridge is a story of American and Soviet citizens and their shared optimism in fragile times, the Cold War. It includes astronauts, New Agers, New Wave rockers, and apparently Muppets. Space Bridge from Radiotopia. This is How Sound, the backstory to great radio storytelling. It's a production of PRX and Transom. Thanks to John Barth, who runs out and buys a dozen red pens when my scripts show up in his inbox. Thanks also to WCAI in Woods Hole, the radio center of the universe. This is Rob Rosenthal. Thanks for listening.
From PRX. And Transom.org.